From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, President Trump is just arriving on the U.S.-Mexico border. He had a message for Democrats before he set off.
I have the absolute right to declare a national emergency. I haven't done it yet. I may do it. If this doesn't work out, probably I will do it. I would almost say definitely.
Also today, how the shutdown is affecting federal employees in Massachusetts.
Basically, we're waiting for a hurricane to hit, and we're not really sure what the damage is going to be. If it drags out and it goes into, you know, weeks and months, that's when you're really going to start seeing the damage.
And we hear from one of the leaders behind the Green New Deal.
As a young person, I am scared about the threat of climate change right now and in the future, and I am angry that people like Donald Trump are putting my life and the lives of billions of others at risk.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's day 20 of the partial government shutdown. The president and congressional Democrats remain in a stalemate. President Trump is in McAllen, Texas, visiting a border patrol station and making his case for a $5.7 billion wall, his signature campaign promise, which he says is critical to national security. Though he previously said he'd be proud to shut down the government over the border wall, today he's blaming Democrats.
The government shut down because Democrats will not fund border security, plain and simple. And again, more than just the walls. Their open borders agenda threatened all American families, including millions of legal immigrants throughout our nation.
Now, some, including the mayor of McAllen, say a wall won't solve America's border issues. So what's really going on down there? Well, here to help us answer that question is WBUR immigration reporter Shannon Dooling. Hey there, Shannon.
Hi, Callum.
So, Shannon, you've reported from McAllen, Texas. Let's start there, where the president is right now. He says there's a humanitarian and security crisis, but the city's mayor, Jim Darling, sees things a bit differently.
I certainly wouldn't call it a crisis. You know, the depiction is the 500 people that we're getting are illegal aliens. And technically, when we get them, they're legal because they're waiting a hearing. So I hate to use the word crisis on the border.
So, Shannon, there's two contrasting assessments of what's going on in the same place. What did you find when you were in McAllen?
Right. When I was in McAllen, it was back in June. So this was sort of at the height of the family separation crisis, a lot of unknowns. And we went down with a delegation of congressmen, congressmen and women from New England. And a few things. There is a very strong and common work-life pattern between those cities along the border. So McAllen, Texas, Brownsville, Texas, which is about an hour's drive away from McAllen to the east. And you get the sense, I mean, it's very common for people to go back and forth. There's you know, people from Mexico cross over to come to work every day. There's a lot of commerce that depends on that border crossing being, you know, a secure but also a efficient place for people to go back and forth. When we were there, we crossed in neighboring Brownsville. And one of the things that stands out to me at that point was, you know, you had to take a quarter and put this quarter into a turnstile sort of, you know, contraption to get basically to get back into the U.S. Before you could, you know, have your U.S. passport sort of inspected. So that, I don't know, that there was just something sort of casual about that, right? Like, make sure you get your quarter before you come over the border. When we were there in June, we hadn't quite seen the spike in asylum seekers that we are hearing about now in, you know, across the southern border. But we did come across a few families who had been waiting right at the border entry in the name of the Mexican city escapes me, but it's at the Brownsville, Texas side of the border. And they had young children that they were waiting for days to present themselves to U.S. authorities to seek asylum. This was at the very beginning of what the U.S. government is calling their sort of metering system to sort of control the flow of how many people they are going to let into the U.S. at a given time to present themselves for asylum, which, of course, is a humanitarian program.
So it sounds like when the president says that there's a humanitarian and security crisis, he's sort of lumping two different things in there, right? I mean, can it be the case that there is a humanitarian crisis in the sense that people are showing up in desperate straits, but that doesn't doesn't necessarily mean that they're rushing the border and trying to cross illegally.
That's right. I mean, there are different numbers, right, that we need to be sure that we're not conflating. And I think that, you know, it's probably easy and quite frankly, in the president's best interest in the sense of supporting his call for this wall, to try to kind of, you know, paint this with broad stripes. You know, there's the asylum crisis, which I would, you know, having been in Tijuana for a few days and seeing the number of people that are coming from very desperate circumstances, living in very desperate conditions, that did have a crisis feeling to me. That did have a humanitarian urgency to me in Tijuana. And this was just a couple weeks ago, last month that we were there. But these are people who are waiting. They're being told by the U.S. government to wait your turn, literally take a number, and you'll get a sense of when you can cross into the U.S. to present yourself to an official. So they're waiting. They're doing what they're told. You know, on the other side of things, and those numbers are going up, people who are presenting themselves at U.S. borders, family units, as they're called. So, you know, families with children. I saw so many young children waiting in Tijuana with their families. Those numbers are up. What has been decreasing, however, is the apprehensions of people who are trying to cross the border illegally. So people who maybe are trying to, you know, skirt in between the official ports of entry and are, you know, being apprehended by Customs and Border Patrol. Those apprehensions, those numbers are down. And so when we're hearing from the president this message about there's a crisis at the border, you know, an open sort of porous place where dangerous criminals and drugs are flooding in every day. I did not get that sense in any of the places, any of the border communities that I've visited over the last year or so. The humanitarian side, I did feel in Tijuana especially, you know, is something that needs to be addressed.
So it's interesting. You've got sort of these graphs going in different directions. I mean, we've got numbers from the United Nations that show that these asylum seekers, the numbers in 2016 were double what they were just a couple of years earlier, to your point. And yet the decrease in the illegal border crossing apprehensions is way down. It was about 1.6 million at its peak in 2000, down to only about 400,000 in the most recent fiscal year. I mean, that's a dramatic decline. And that's the group that presumably would be stopped by a wall, right? Those people trying to get across.
That's right. And you know, we've heard from government officials along the border on both sides of the border, on the Mexican side and on the American side, saying, listen, you know, we have technology that's increased our ability to spot people who are trying to sneak over the border. We, you know, that has led to this sort of like decline in some of the illegal border crossings. You know, these people who are coming from other parts of Mexico, who are coming from Central America, who are fearing for their safety in their home countries, you can build the tallest wall out of the strongest material that this world has ever seen. And many of these people will still make their way to the southern border and try to apply for asylum. And the reason they're going to do it is because you cannot deter someone who's running for their lives, essentially. And in many cases, those are the stories that we were told in Tijuana, where people who were at their wit's end. They have small children. They don't know what else to do. They're aware of the asylum process in the U.S. They take months to get there, and now they're waiting their turn.
I know that one of your trips to the border was with a congressional delegation from New England. Mm-hmm. What did you hear from them? I mean, we're not in a border area, obviously. I imagine that perhaps we've heard some of them, Democrats, all of them in Massachusetts, talk more about visa overstays, for example, than illegal border crossings.
Right. I mean, you know what? The thing with immigration is it's a bit unwieldy, right? When we talk about this big topic of immigration, I mean, there's so many different facets of it. When we talk about policies, there's policies that pertain to security that inherently will focus on the borders. And then there's policies that refer to people who are already in the U.S., so people with visas, people who overstay their visas, TPS recipients, Dreamers. I mean, we can't forget that in the middle of all of this, yes, there are, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of federal workers that are struggling. There are also hundreds of thousands of TPS recipients and Dreamers who have no idea what their fate is right now either. And so there's a lot at stake.
WBUR immigration reporter Shannon Dooling. Please stay with us. But speaking of the congressional delegation that I mentioned a moment ago, the House is in session as we speak, but we did catch up with Massachusetts Congressman Joe Kennedy moments ago on his way to the House floor, and I began by asking him what he's hearing from constituents on day 20 of this shutdown.
We're hearing that everybody wants to get back to work and that we want the shutdown to end. And I could not agree more, obviously. It's frustrating. It is not the government that the American public, I think, deserves or should demand. And this could end and should have never started to begin with. And so I hope the president goes back to the deal that he agreed to 20 days ago and opens up government.
Do you think that's likely?
I don't know what's likely with President Trump, and that's part of the problem. I think even our Republican colleagues would acknowledge that it becomes awfully hard to negotiate with an individual who continues to change the negotiating position. And I think it's really important for everybody to understand the government funding bill that was up right before Christmas passed the Senate bipartisan 100-0. It was scheduled to come over to the House, and it was going to have broad bipartisan support here, and it failed after the right-wing folks in the Republican Party spun up conservative media. There has been a couple of bills that we have voted on since Democrats came in power here in the House that would open up government, and they have passed with bipartisan support. We've got Republicans on board to open up government. There's four or five, I believe, Republican senators that are calling on the president to open up government at this point. There is bipartisan agreement here to open up the government. It is the president, essentially, that is standing in the way.
And he hinted at what his next move might be. He's in Texas this afternoon, but on his way as he was departing Washington, he told reporters that he will probably declare a national emergency if the deadlock over funding for his border wall continues. First of all, Congressman, in your view, does he have the authority to declare that emergency? And if he does, what would you and the House do?
The answer on this is, does he have the authority to do it? He probably has the authority to do it. Does that mean it will withstand legal scrutiny? No, it doesn't, and that is very much up in the air. And certainly, even if he might have the legal authority to do it, should he do it? The answer to that is absolutely not. Look, this is it would be an unprecedented grab of presidential power, certainly in modern American history, and I don't say that lightly. You talk to my conservative colleagues here, they are very uneasy about this, understanding that while a border wall might be something that they support, the prospect of setting a precedent here for a series of policies that a Democratic president could then put in place is something that I think makes everybody uneasy when it just comes to with regards to the acquisition here of power by an executive. And the fact is that if the president is looking for a comprehensive fix to immigration reform, I'm all in. This has been a policy priority of a number of us here for years. We'd like to do that. You can open up government and address those concerns. If you want to find a way to get to yes on a series of challenges here, we're all in on that too. There's no reason to keep 800,000 American families, folks that work for the federal government, hostage to try to get a policy proposal that he largely ran a campaign on here in the midterms and lost.
We do have something called the National Emergencies Act for this type of situation. It requires the president to notify Congress when an emergency is declared and to list the powers that he is invoking. The law also requires the administration to provide regular updates to Congress, and it allows lawmakers to terminate an emergency if both the House and Senate vote to do so. We, of course, Congressman, have a divided Congress with Republicans still in control of the Senate. So do you suppose that would be the mechanism to challenge such an order, or would it perhaps come in the courts?
I think it will certainly come in the courts immediately. I expect Congress will challenge it as well. Look, there is, I think, almost no objective measure by which there is an emergency on our southern border. The border arrivals in raw numbers are down from where they were decades ago. The numbers that are up in terms of subsets of those numbers recently are essentially women and children. To the extent that there's an issue and a crisis with unaccompanied children that have been separated either from their families or people coming across, that is a crisis and a humanitarian crisis that we have to deal with that was created by the policies put forth by this administration. The other crisis that we have to deal with is the 800,000 families that are now out of work, the grinding to a halt of essential basic government function, the fact that Coast Guard Station in Boston is conducting a food drive for the members of our Coast Guard because they're not getting a paycheck. That's where we should be, our focus should be. We can open up government immediately and then turn our concerns to a very real issue that, again, is important to me and that I've gone down to the border a number of times since I've been in Congress. We need to address these concerns. This is not the way to do it.
But as you know, the president makes a humanitarian case for why he's holding his position. Now, we just heard him speaking in Texas moments ago at a roundtable. He made the point or the argument that a wall could help stop human trafficking.
The president's argument that this is some sort of humanitarian an act of humanitarian graciousness is about as laughable as it gets from somebody that has done more to inflict more pain on immigrants and immigrant families than any president that I can think of, certainly in modern American history. So one, I don't even want to engage in that discussion. Two, once again, his speech, from what I understand just moments ago, and certainly his speech in Address to the Nation, was filled with falsehoods and misrepresentations. Yes, we have issues with narcotics coming across our southern border. The vast majority of those narcotics come through existing ports of entry, which is why there was proposals to actually strengthen ports of entry. The human trafficking is certainly an issue. A lot of that comes through the ports of entry as well. The issue that we have at the moment, the migrant numbers that we are seeing coming across to our southern border, those are from individuals seeking asylum who actually are trying to present themselves to border guards, to border patrol officials, to actually engage in a legal process to gain asylum. This is not an issue of a vast influx of individuals trying to sneak across our border, as he would like to have you believe. That is part of the frustration in this, is that most of our colleagues, Democrats and Republicans, will acknowledge, one, the president's positions on this keep changing, and two, his arguments on this are filled with falsehoods, which, again, I think really critical for people to understand. Of all of the House members that represent communities along our border, Democrat and Republican, every single one of them has come out against this wall. Every one of them, Democrat and Republican, have come out against this wall. This is not a partisan issue. This is actually one where the folks confronted with this most closely believe it is ineffective, inefficient, and not the correct policy solution. And we have bipartisan support, Democrat, Republican, to open up the government right now, House and Senate. The president is the only thing standing in the way, and it's heartbreaking and sad and so not surprising.
Just to fill in some detail on those illegal border crossings, they were about 400,000 last year. That's about a quarter of what they were at their peak in 2000. Last thing before you go, Congressman, just a practical standpoint, a negotiating point. I mean, we have a federal budget of about $4 trillion. The president's asking for $5.7 billion. It's a relative drop in the bucket. What about the argument, you know, just throw him a bone, give him his wall, and if it buys you, say, DACA, it would be money well spent?
Look, this is not one, just because somebody has a terrible policy idea doesn't mean you just waste billions of dollars of taxpayer money on terrible policy ideas. Two, if you want to engage in a discussion around comprehensive immigration reform, we can do that. You don't keep 800,000 American families hostage in order to do so. You engage in that process the way that every other member of government in recent American history has done so. That's what we should do. That's what this discussion should be about. Again, that's where this was 3 weeks ago when a bill passed 100-0 out of the United States Senate. The president needs to make up his mind. I would urge him to listen to House Republicans that are calling on him to open up the government, Senate Republicans that are calling on him to open up the government, and open up the government and engage in the discussions around immigration reform.
Congressman Joseph Kennedy III joining us from Washington. Congressman, thanks again for your time.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Let's turn now to someone with a different view on this. Mary Lou Daxland is president of the Massachusetts Republican Assembly, which is not officially affiliated with the Mass GOP, but certainly represents the views of many Republicans in the state. Mary Lou, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me. It's laughable, the talking points that Congressman Kennedy has down. I mean, I'm just going to say one thing. The
Please.
Speech that the President Trump gave the other night, the fact checkers were giving opinion because every fact was correct in that speech. And I don't believe there is one Republican that is along a border state that is not for the wall. This is just unbelievable propaganda that the Democrats are putting out. And yes, this is liberal Massachusetts. And the president asked us to call our congressmen and our senators. Do you think they're going to listen to the conservatives in Massachusetts? Of course not. It's a liberal state with a weak governor. who's a so-called Republican with his D next to his name. So basically, even I heard the clip with the reporter that you had on. You people need to look outside of the alphabet stations to see what's actually being filmed on the border. There has been a caravan coming up for months. And yes, there are less border crossings because since Trump has been president, there's been more people put on the border.
But that's a broad, Mary Lou, that's a broad trend over the course of 16 plus years. I mean, that's multiple administrations, not just a Trump thing. But can I ask you, Mary Lou, can I ask, because you mentioned, and we've only got a couple of minutes, so I do want to ask you, you mentioned that all the Republicans along the border are in support of the wall. But there, I have heard some Republicans, though, raise some concern that the president might give away too much, you know, that he'd be so fixated on the wall that perhaps he would trade too much to the Democrats. Is that a worry that you have here, that his fixation will cost?
I don't think. First off, I want the government opened like everybody else does. But Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, they all voted in years past to put a lot more money into a wall, and it never got implemented under Obama. And you people just are just kicking the can down the road, and President Trump is standing tall because I don't believe for a minute, and none of the conservatives in this country believe for one minute, if he opens the government, they're going to come to the table. This whole thing is a hate mongering of a president that isn't part of the establishment in either party, and you people will never, ever give him credit for anything. And we need to come to the table, and we need to talk to each other. And Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are not doing that. And
well, I think,
it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong.
But Mary Lou, I think one of the objections, though, here is that the president himself isn't following through or hasn't yet followed through on his promise. Remember, the wall was going to be built so fast your head was going to spin. It was going to be paid for by Mexico. I mean, I'm wondering, and his latest effort may be to declare a state of emergency and use military funds, or so he says, to build the wall. I mean, would that satisfy you if you get the wall, but not in the way that he has promised?
No, because what wasn't going to, you're splitting hairs here saying the president didn't get this done. Well, he's done other things like tax reform that has changed the economy drastically in this country that you will not give him credit for. So if he builds the wall, and it is needed because they have proven in every stretch along the southern border where a wall has been put up, it has stopped the drug traffic coming through and illegals coming through. And it's the humanitarian thing. They need to separate these children from these so-called parents to stop human trafficking. And they have caught a lot of this going on in the border in the last several years. But again, it's sad that the Democrats will not even talk to this man. I mean, you've got a veteran that started a GoFundMe page to fund the wall, and there are America, it's, what is it, up to $15 million? So the American public wants this wall, and it's the same vicious circle that everybody keeps going around. The reporters keep going around, the liberal left keeps going around, but nobody's solving it. And the DACA kids are sitting out there, but nobody's solving it. And whose fault it is? Us, the voter, that keeps voting in these candidates year after year after year, and they give us lip service. And Joe Kennedy is among all of them. And it isn't just Democrats, it's Republicans. And that's where we really need to look at this. It's a crisis. It is a crisis. There's more young people dying of drugs. Where is it coming from? It's coming south of this country.
And I think, Mary Lou, though, as you know, there are some clever smugglers who would find a way to get those drugs in, regardless of whether there is a wall there or not. But we'll have to leave it there. Mary Lou Daxland is president of the Massachusetts Republican Assembly. Mary Lou, thank you very much for your time today.
You're welcome.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. President Trump is in McAllen, Texas this hour at the U.S.-Mexico border to make his argument for a wall as the partial government shutdown goes into day 20. That means tomorrow, many of the 800,000 federal employees who are furloughed or working without pay are set to miss their first regularly scheduled paycheck since the shutdown started. 8,200 of them are in Massachusetts, according to the Washington Post. Gabriel Pedrera is a legislative and political organizer at the American Federation of Government Employees, or AFGE. It's a federal employee union representing 700,000 government workers. He talked to Radio Boston about what's at stake for the affected workers.
Many of these workers do not earn six-figure salaries. The average TSA officer earns $35,000 a year, and many of them do live paycheck to paycheck. And to have in the 21st century, 2019, full-time employees going to work for no money is nothing short of a national disgrace.
And so we're talking to people in Greater Boston about the effects of the shutdown. And here to help us do that conversation is Mike Gazagian. He's a TSA officer at Boston Logan Airport, meaning he's among those working without pay. And he's also acting president of Local 2617 of the American Federation of Government Employees, which represents TSA workers in Massachusetts, New Hampshire, and Maine. Mike, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And still with us, filling in some context for the story, is WBUR immigration reporter Shannon Dueling. Hey there again, Shannon.
Hello.
All right. So, Mike, I understand today is a day off for you anyway.
Yes, it is.
When you've been going into work, at least recently, have you been feeling the weight of the shutdown, or do you think it'll only sort of sink in when you don't get that paycheck tomorrow?
Well, I think it's like a hurricane that we're all expecting. It hasn't hit yet. We expect a lot of damage. We don't know what exactly is going to happen, but once it hits, we're going to see what happens. And there's a lot of anxiety amongst the officers, and you know, we're waiting to see what happens tomorrow. I'm anticipating that there isn't going to be a deal made, and so people are going to be missing their deposits and their checks, and you know, and it begins.
You say there's anxiety. That's certainly understandable. How does that show up? We've heard reports elsewhere about long lines in airports because TSA agents are calling sick, and who could blame them in some ways? They're not getting paid. Is that going on at Logan?
That's not going on at Logan. I haven't heard anything about that at Logan or in New Hampshire or in Maine. We're all showing up to work. I know when I go in, the people I work with, they're all coming in. So I think it's a lot of hype.
So on the topic of these hundreds of thousands of workers who've been going without their paychecks during the shutdown, we heard from President Trump at a news conference just yesterday saying that he's heard from some of those workers or seen posts from them in social media supporting his hardline stance.
So many of those people are saying, it's very hard for me, it's very hard for my family, but Mr. President, you're doing the right thing. Get it done. I've had so many of them. They're patriots. They love our country. And they want to see it be done.
Mike, is that capture the sentiment of your union workers? I mean, are they also saying, hey, hang in there. We don't mind not getting paid in the meantime until we get this wall?
I'm not hearing that. I mean, I know everybody has their own personal political opinions, but as federal employees, we're not supposed to be political. So we're not out there expressing our opinions, at least professionally and while we're on duty. And, you know, for the TSA, our prime focus is airport security, not border security. So, you know, that is a fight that we're not involved in, or we shouldn't be involved in. It's unfair to involve us in it. We're stuck in the middle of a political game. And, you know, if this were, let's say, a public company, say, you know, a Google or an Apple or any public company where the board of directors and the CEO get into a fight over what kind of security system to put in their buildings and they shut down their business and, you know, laid off all their workers, the shareholders would not accept that. Shareholders would throw them out right away. And this is kind of a similar situation here. So we really have to get the public involved, and you know, they have to step up and say, you know what, we're not going to tolerate this. This is ridiculous.
What would that take, though? I mean, you and your coworkers would feel the pain tomorrow if you don't get a paycheck. Will the general public not feel it until they do start missing flights or the security lines take forever?
You know, everything has a lag. And so, you know, like I said, we don't know what's going to happen. I know that we have very dedicated men and women at TSA who are going to come to work. And, you know, but they have to make ends meet. And, you know, we have a large contingent of part-time people who probably, you know, have other jobs. And so I guess, you know, if you have a job that's paying you and you have a job that's not paying you, where are you going to go? So, but, you know, like I said, the officers are very dedicated. We've got great staff. We do a dangerous job. And I really think the public needs to come out and support us.
So, Shannon, there's a certain irony here. I mean, we're talking about TSA agents here in particular, but there's a broad swath of government employees affected, including some, by the way, who enforce our immigration laws. They are, in some cases, among those who are furloughed or not getting paid right now. What kind of toll does that have? Because this fight is about, at least from the president's perspective, fortifying
our immigration. It's about security, right? It's about border security. And I think that's what was kind of going through my head while Mike, you were talking about your situation at TSA is that, you know, this entire shutdown was precipitated under this narrative of border security and needing to bolster security at the border. And yet, as it rolls on and on and on, things like the E-Verify program have taken a toll where many employers are not able to access that program. And that's, of course, something that many on the right have tried to encourage every employer to have. It sort of is a backdrop in which you can confirm a person's status, their legal authority to work in the country. So that's not up and running right now. The lines at the immigration court are just kind of piling up and up and up. Immigration judges are showing up and coming to work, but a lot of the staff that support them are not getting paid, and they are not coming and showing up to work. And our colleague Simone Rios just did a story about this in Boston, where many people expect. I mean, Boston has one of the largest backlogs in the country in terms of immigration courts.
And already.
And that's just going to keep compounding. So there certainly is a bit of an irony. I mean, I can't get members from DHS or ICE or many of the other press offices to respond to press inquiries right now because I get an automated email that says we are not able to work right now by law. So if you still have a question, you know, when we're up and running again, come and ask us. So, I mean, how are we supposed to do our jobs in a certain vein? I mean, there is a heavy sense of irony it's compounding the problem in many ways, not just at the very human and real level of people who are working without pay, but systematically. It's going to take us a while to get out from under this as well.
Yeah, whichever side you blame for the shutdown, there's a big ripple effect.
That's
and
true.
It includes, by the way, government contractors, not just people who work directly for the federal government. And so to help add that perspective is Jim Cassetta. He's the CEO of Work Incorporated, which is a nonprofit organization here in Boston that develops programs for people with disabilities. And it's one of its functions is to connect those individuals with contract work in Boston's federal buildings. About 150 of them, I understand, Jim, do some of that work. Could you fill in exactly what that work entails and how they're being affected right now?
That's correct. We have about 150 individuals with significant disabilities working under many, many federal contracts. We manage the total facilities management at the John F. Kennedy Library, which unfortunately is closed. NARA, National Archives and Records Administration, is out of business because of the partial shutdown, and we have about 20 individuals who will not be receiving any pay tomorrow because tomorrow is our payday. And these folks, and I'm not at all comparing them against federal employees, but these folks require case management support services, and they may or may not have the cognitive or the ability to go out and get a part-time job in the interim. So we've had several important, significant meetings over the last few days by trying to pay them whatever accrued benefits they do have. But best case scenario, if this drags on by the end of next week, the 32 folks at Work Inc. with disabilities who are out of work will have no income. The EPA in Boston and the John F. Kennedy Library are closed. Rumor has it that GSA, the General Services Administration, which houses about 100 additional folks with disabilities, may also have to curtail its services. We do custodial, total facilities management, snow removal, fleet management, mailroom management, essential contracted employees, and we would need special legislation passed by Congress to guarantee back pay for these particular individuals. So it's a double whammy for us, and it's just awful.
I'll point out we spoke earlier this week with our new Congresswoman, Ayanna Pressley, who's proposed legislation to do just that.
Exactly, we appreciate that.
I do want to ask you, though, you mentioned the perhaps lack of options in the meantime. I understand, you know, part of the work that your nonprofit does is to place people in jobs, and that can be a process, right? It's not always easy to find those jobs, right? And so if this work dries up for now, you know, it's not necessarily that they can find work in a pinch, right?
No, it takes time. It takes retraining. Right now, all of our people placed in federal buildings are trained for the job that they're required to do, custodial, HVAC, electrical, snow removal, et cetera. In order for us to reassign them to another job would take, could be conceivably weeks of training without pay. We're looking at funded vacancies within our own company, and I'll put out the word to anybody who may be looking for these types of jobs, we can probably provide them at least interim workers until this ridiculous situation gets resolved.
Mike, you know, as we're talking about alternatives, we heard from the Coast Guard yesterday, which is the only branch of the military to have its pay suspended by the shutdown. They put up a tip sheet, you know, for their workers. Hey, if you're looking for alternative income during the shutdown, they suggested employees might take to babysitting or hold garage sales to offset the financial strain. They ultimately took it down after some blowback. What do you make of that kind of suggestion?
Well, they're not realistic suggestions. I understand the effort that people want to make an effort. And that's great. But, you know, I mean, the banks want their money. Creditors want their money. Landlords want their money, and rightfully so. And, you know, people want to make good on their obligations, on their financial obligations. And so, you know, to be put in the middle of a political fight, and then you're all of a sudden you're facing, you know, for some people, financial disaster, because if you're, you know, you miss your mortgage payment or you miss your credit card payment, there goes your credit. And in the federal government, you have to maintain good credit. I mean, it's just a reality of the business. So it's amazing what kind of I don't understand why both sides can't just, you know, come together and make a different deal than they have. They shouldn't have to dig in as hard as they have on this. I mean, there are solutions out there that they could find, I'm sure. But, you know, it really doesn't have anything to do with the federal workforce. You know, the federal workforce didn't create the border situation, and the federal workforce isn't going to be able to solve the border situation. So, you know, it's something that, you know, it's not fair to us. It just simply is. It's an unfair position to put us in.
Even though we can't see the end of this shutdown in sight, we assume it will come eventually. But I'm curious, Mike, about the long-term effect here, or if you think there could be one. I mean, in other words, if you're hiring people to work for the TSA or other government agencies, do you worry that it could be harder to do that, to find quality people if they feel like, you know what, that's not a stable job, because who knows when the next shutdown is coming, I might not get paid.
Absolutely.
Will recruitment be harder?
Absolutely. Recruitment is hard enough. I mean, we're in a great economy, and there's plenty of opportunities out there. And these employers are all competing heavily for workers. And so, you know, if you have the option of going to a job that's going to pay you versus a job that may not, then where are you going to go? It's a very simple calculation people have to make. And, you know, TSA requires a lot of people, a lot of good qualified people. And so we have to, you know, that the agency has to compete with, you know, the new casino that's opening up, and, you know, all the other tech companies that are coming in. So young people who are coming out of school or looking for different jobs, they have so many options. And so for the government to turn around and basically slam the door on these people and say, you know what, you got to wait. You know, so it makes no sense to me from a business perspective.
It's tough. Shannon, last question to you, as we see the stalemate continuing here, and nobody has the crystal ball, but it seems like such an intractable issue that both sides have staked out extreme positions, with, you know, the House Speaker Nancy Pelosi saying the wall is an immorality that would seem to leave little room for compromise.
Right.
And the president saying, you know, maybe he'd be willing to change the material from concrete to steel, but not really giving in on the wall. What do our prospects look like of resolving this anytime soon, so that these guys can get back to work?
I mean, like you said, I do not have a crystal ball, but I just simply don't see what the negotiating chips are right now. They exist. They exist, and they've been on the table before, but they're not looking appealing to either side right now. And so, as we've said, in the meantime, real life financial implications for workers, and real life implications for our immigration system as a whole.
That's WBUR immigration reporter Shannon Dooling. Shannon, thanks for hanging with us for two segments.
You're welcome.
And also our thanks to Mike Gazagian. He's a TSA officer at Boston Logan Airport and president of the American Federation of Government Employees. Thanks for your story, Mike.
Thanks.
And Jim Cassetta, chief executive and president of Work, Inc. Thanks for being here as well.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Stick with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston. Finally today, we want to hear about a political movement with lofty ambitions to combat the effects of climate change. It's called a Green New Deal, an environmentalist spin on FDR's Depression-era social program. Here's Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez explaining the Green New Deal to 60 Minutes' Anderson Cooper.
You're talking about zero carbon emissions, no use of fossil fuels within 12 years?
That is the goal. It's ambitious. And
how is that possible? You're talking about everybody having to drive an electric car?
It's going to require a lot of rapid change that we don't even conceive as possible right now. What is the problem with trying to push our technological capacities to the furthest extent possible?
Technological capacities, but it might be our political capacities and those harsh realities in Washington that pose the biggest challenges to a Green New Deal. So with me in studio is one of the Boston-based leaders of the push for a Green New Deal. Varshini Prakash is a co-founder of the Sunrise Movement. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Kellen.
So we heard on that tape from Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez some of the broad sketches of the Green New Deal. Could you fill in some more details for us?
Sure, absolutely. So when we talk about a Green New Deal, what we are talking about is an umbrella term for the kinds of programs and policies that get us off fossil fuels fast, a transitioning to an 100% renewable energy economy to stop the climate crisis. And in the process, creating millions upon millions of good-paying new jobs and supporting communities on the front lines of poverty and pollution. So digging more deeply into what some of these pillars of a Green New Deal might involve, we've been discussing what it looks like to eliminate all warming emissions in virtually every sector of society by the year 2030, in the next 12 years. We've been exploring a job guarantee that would guarantee a job to any American who wants or needs one cleaning up the climate crisis. We're talking about massive investment in communities of color, frontline communities who are the first to bear the brunt of the climate crisis and oftentimes the last to get help. So we're talking about a socioeconomic project to rival some of the greatest projects in history, as you talked about and as the name suggests, like the New Deal for FDR.
The New Yorker writing about the Green New Deal recently said it would be, quote, nothing less than a total overhaul of our national infrastructure. That gives you a sense of what the scope we're talking about here. Any idea what it would cost, Varshini?
Sure. Well, I think when we think about what it would cost, we're talking about massive investments, right? We're talking about an actual investment in our country. We're talking about the creation of tens of millions of good jobs for working Americans that would actually create a massive boost to our economy. We're talking about supporting communities and improving people's lives by lowering the costs of disease, of asthma, of cancers, of all of these things that being addicted, our fossil fuel addiction, our addiction to oil and gas and burning these products is causing for us. So I think when we look at the long term of this, what it means is actually if we don't start taking immediate action starting today, and every year that we delay action, we're actually making it a lot more costly for ourselves. I believe 2017 was the most costliest year on record when it came to disasters, $400 billion. And that's not even to include the cost, the emotional toll on people's lives of losing almost 5,000 people in Puerto Rico after Maria, the almost 100 people who were burnt alive in their homes following the Camp Fires and the Mendocino Complex fires from earlier this year.
So without a specific dollar figure, I take it it's a big price tag. But if I gather right, you're saying the cost of not doing this would be even higher in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. And I think it's going to take a lot of investment. But something I do want to point out is that we seem to have the money for lots of things. We seem to have the money for a $1.7 trillion tax giveaway to the wealthiest of the wealthy in this country. So if we have dollars, if we have money to pad the pockets of billionaires and to pay for fighter jets, then I think we can scrape together the money to improve people's access to clean air and clean water, allow people to live out the rest of their lives in peace and dignity, and not throw a generation of people like me and every generation to come into chaos and violence and uncertainty. And I just want to name, this is a large reason why we're pushing for it on this scale is because thousands of scientists released a landmark report last year, the UN climate scientists, or the IPCC report, which says that this will require unprecedented changes to every level of our economy and society. So this is actually based in reality of what it's going to take to protect people's lives.
And that UN report did have some dire warnings for the Boston area as well, but perhaps we haven't seen as much extreme weather here as in other places. You mentioned, you know, the fires in California, hurricanes in the southern part of the United States and in Puerto Rico. You're a local, so I'm curious what, you know, you weren't in the midst of those particular disasters. What drew you into this cause, Varshini?
Absolutely. So everything about why I fight on climate has to do with my family and where I'm from. I was born and raised in Massachusetts, but I am the child of two South Indian immigrants. And the way in which the climate crisis is wreaking havoc in India and places around the world, especially the global South, is heartbreaking. In 2015, we saw an extremely strong monsoon season that caused some of the worst floods in Chennai, India, and southern India. We saw a million people being put in refugee camps in Kerala, India, where my family is from, unable to return to their homes. People in my family had to house people for weeks because of the destruction that was caused to people's homes and livelihoods. So this is not a crisis of 30 years, 50 years from now. This is affecting people in this moment, millions and millions of people. And when I think I just don't believe that any person should have to live in fear of losing the people that they love or the places that they call home to crises that are preventable. We've known about the climate crisis for 50 years. And in that time, we've seen the way that oil and gas money in our politics has really led to misinforming the public on the scientific validity of climate change. We've seen the way in which political parties have been completely bought out to fuel that climate denialism. The GOP, receives almost 80%+ of the amount of oil and gas money right now, and we've seen that the effect of that when we've seen the way that they've wholeheartedly embraced climate denialism and completely halted progress on the issue.
Let's talk politics then for a little bit, because we've seen some other progressive causes in recent years catch fire, but maybe not have a strong political strategy. I'm thinking of something like Occupy Wall Street, right? Big movement, got a lot of attention. There wasn't that focus, though, on we endorse these candidates, we get them into office, and we work within the system to enact change. Your group, the Sunrise Movement, seems to have a different tack. Is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. So what Sunrise is really trying to do is get fossil fuel money out of politics, elect climate champions to office, and kick out fossil fuel-funded politicians as well who are stymieing progress, and really start to actually build the political and the public consensus around the real solutions to the climate crisis that are at scale with what science and justice demand. So to that effect, we're really combining both protest and demonstration to get the urgency of the climate crisis out into the public. That's why we did a demonstration 3 months ago outside of Nancy Pelosi's office that Rep. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez also joined, and which has really fueled the excitement and the movement around a Green New Deal.
We actually have a little bit of sound from that event if we'd like to take a listen. Here's a flavor if you missed it.
Democrats!
I see you smiling as you recall that episode. In the moments that we have left, I mean, is that what we should expect more of in 2019, more events like that? I understand you've got a big planning conference call tonight. What's next in the immediate planning for
you? Absolutely. So for 2019, we are working to bring the Green New Deal to every American that we possibly can. It starts tonight. We have over 2,000 young people who are going to be attending a call to hear about the campaign for a Green New Deal and bring it to their contexts and communities. And we are going to be making sure that any politician in America who is seeking federal office backs a Green New Deal and stops taking money from the oil and gas executives who are threatening our futures.
Varshini Prakash is a co-founder of the Sunrise Movement, a group that is pushing for a Green New Deal. Varshini, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, and Eve Zukoff, with Walt Wolfman. Tim Skog is our technical director. We had help today from Matt Lissette. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.